Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, I'm delighted to welcome you to our Thursday afternoon lecture series. Please, if you haven't already, feel free to help yourself to a cup of coffee or some tea. My name is Jennifer Tischler. I'm the Associate Director of CRECA, and I'm filling in for our Director, Yoy Herrera, who is on her way to University of Michigan to give a talk at their Russian, Eurasian, and Eastern Europeans Center. So since this is the first talk of the spring 2012 semester, for those of you who are new to this program, I wanted to encourage you to take a flyer. We have a printout of CRECA lectures coming up for the rest of the semester. Next week's talk will also be given by a UW-Madison professor, Volker Radloff, professor of forest and wildlife ecology, on the topic land use change and biodiversity after the collapse of the Soviet Union. CRECA does have an email distribution list announcing lectures, concerts, other cultural events, so if you're not already on that list, please add your name. There's a sign-up sheet in the back of the room. And now on to the matter at hand. I hesitate to use the word introduce because I know that David is already someone who's very well known to many of you here in the room. David Danaher is professor of Slavic languages and literature at UW-Madison and has been a member of the UW faculty since 1998. We at CRECA have been known to talk about our three-part mission of teaching, outreach, and research on this critical world region, and as an ally and friend and supporter of CRECA, David has really made remarkable contributions to all three of these spheres. In teaching, he has taught or is currently teaching both Russian and Czech in the Department of Slavic Languages, Russian and Czech language, literature, and linguistics for both undergrads and grads. He developed a monograph course on Václav Havel. I imagine that some of you in the room are familiar with that course, and restructured, revived, and is now teaching for the second time CRECA's interdisciplinary course on Central and Eastern Europe, a core course for us. And he has received numerous awards for his teaching, including a prestigious award from the Wisconsin Alumni Association. In research, David has published numerous articles in the fields of literature and linguistics with reference to both Russian and Czech. And his current book project, Reading Václav Havel, examines the contemporary, and this is directly from your website, David, relevance of the Czech absurdist playwright, dissident, and non-political politician Václav Havel, who is considered one of the most influential intellectuals of our time. And I'll mention just one of David's recent outreach events. That was to appear as an invited guest on the Wisconsin Public Radio program Here on Earth on December 22nd, very soon after the death of Havel. And David appeared to talk about Havel's legacy on this program. And today he'll be discussing rereading Václav Havel's Power of the Powerless. So please join me in welcoming David.
It's always a little disorienting to hear an introduction about yourself, and I thought I didn't need any introduction, but that was, wow. Well, it's a pleasure to inaugurate CRECA's spring 2012 lecture series, and plus we get cookies and coffee because there's an inauguration. And it's also an honor, really, to be able to use this to commemorate Václav Havel's memory. As probably most of you know, he died about a month ago, just before Christmas. And I didn't realize at the time that I was working on Havel, and I've been working on him for 10 years or so, how difficult it actually is to work on a living author. And it's a little bit selfish of me because one of my first reactions was, after he died, it hit me all of a sudden, wow, it all makes sense now, right? But at the same time, it was more like there's a tremendous responsibility, a greater responsibility that falls on the shoulders of those of us who study Havel now that he is no longer living. We have an obligation to start summing up his life and his work, and to try in doing so not to fall into two traps. On the one hand, there's the trap of the speaker in Ionesco's famous absurdist play, The Chairs. So if you don't know this play, there's an old man and an old woman in the play, and they're nearing the end of their lives. And they're not very well educated, and they hire a professional speaker to sum up their long lives in a noble oration. So the speaker shows up to deliver his speech to a room full of empty chairs, except for the audience who's occupying chairs and facing the speaker. But all that emerges from the speaker's mouth is inhuman screeching. The speech isn't remotely intelligible. So that's the first trap that I would like to avoid today. The second trap is more difficult to avoid. In attempting to sum up Václav Havel's life, I'd ideally like to be faithful to Havel himself and not reinvent Havel in my own image. And as Jennifer just mentioned, I'm writing a book entitled Reading Havel. And so one of the chapters in this book will be a rereading of Power of the Powerless. And a year ago, I was talking to a colleague of mine at another university who also studies Czech and the culture of dissent. And I mentioned that I was working on this book project and what the book project was about. And he said, his reaction was, "It's so wonderful that someone is going to write a book about what Havel actually said." And we looked at each other for a moment. We both burst out laughing. Because it's funny to say something like that, right? You'd think that people would write books and articles on what Havel really said. But we both knew that the truth is that people don't. So whether this is because Havel was so famous and seemingly known, or whether it's because he wrote about subjects that an awful lot of highly educated people already thought that they themselves fully understood, or maybe a bit of both, Havel is often misread, and sometimes dramatically so. And I think, as we all know, it's not difficult to bring a set of preconceptions to the reading of a text. And so this is kind of an additional trap that we need to avoid in reading Havel. And I will be illustrating this with regard to his most famous, probably his most famous essay, 1978, Power of the Powerless, which is also considered one of the most influential dissident essays ever written. At the same time, I'd like to present a new and general framework for thinking about Havel, for reading him, or rather a framework for rereading or reframing him as a writer, thinker, and a politician. And the first thing we need to do to understand the features of this framework and how Power of the Powerless fits into this framework, we have to take a down and dirty look, a sketch at Havel's genres, the genres that he engaged in his lifetime. And there were at least 8 such genres. And I list these chronologically. So 1950s and 1960s were characterized by literary critical analysis. Havel was, I speak to the Slav history, Havel was one of us. He was quite young. He didn't have formal education, but he was a quite brilliant analyst of literature and film. Very few of these are actually known to English-speaking scholars of Havel's life because most of them have not been translated. In fact, almost none of them have been translated. And yet they represent the cornerstone of Havel as a thinker. Havel establishes himself here as a keen analyst of text in the humanities tradition, and he analyzes mostly the structure of text, literary devices. But under Havel's pen, these devices aren't content to remain in the text. They become conceptual strategies that are active in the human mind beyond the confines of a literary text, a play, or a film. And one of the most known essays in this genre is Anatomy of the Gag, Anatomia Gagu, which is an analysis of the cinematic gag, if we think of Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton here. And Havel confidently claims in this essay that how a gag defamiliarizes represents a form of modern-day existential catharsis. So we can see he goes well beyond literary devices as such. Second genre chronologically is typographic poetry, what he called the anticodes from the 1960s. And you have one example in your handout of an anticode. He typed, this was obviously before modern computing, he typed hundreds of these non-traditional poems that mix very highbrow themes, mostly about aspects of modern man's existential or civilizational crisis, with a very playful form. Most are schematic in nature. They suggest a template that has multiple applications to human experience, both personal and social. And they're characterized, as you can tell, by a tight form-meaning nexus. Most can, in fact, be reduced to a central image. And as one critic has noted, that image tends to dig easily into your mind. You remember that. You recall that image. And the image, in fact, represents the poem's larger argument. So in your handout, you have, this is one of a series of anticodes that Havel wrote with the word człowiek, which means person or man in a generic sense. And what we have there is kind of the word itself is chopped up, right? Separated by all of these and graphed on the background of a bunch of numbers. And so it's as if fragmenting human identity, right? If we think of a word being chopped up, the equivalent would be chopping up body parts and spreading them out. And you know, one of the ways that we can interpret this, we just did this Wednesday in our discussion section for Krika 254, was the idea that, you know, people are no longer people anymore. They're numbers. And we can actually spout off to the extent to which we're numbers. Social security number, student ID number, telephone number, percentage of taxes we pay on our income, et cetera. So another genre, which is one of the most well-known genre, are Havel's plays, 60s, 70s, 80s. His last play was 2007. There's some speculation that he was nearing the end of a play right before he died. And we could characterize these plays as French absurdism combined with Czech theater of the appeal. More on that in a moment. So this is, although this is a well-known Havelian genre, its scholars still treat it rather separately from these other genres, and maybe because they don't quite know what to do with French absurdism combined with Czech theater of the appeal. Havel, however, took theater as a form very seriously, and he stated on a number of occasions in a number of different ways that the dramatic form, or rather his style of writing plays, is aimed at, quote, uncovering something like the very structure of being, displaying in vivid terms its internal weave, its hidden fabric, and its real articulation, unquote. Havel's plays intentionally provoke and disturb the audience. As theater of the appeal, they were designed to provoke the audience into introspection and self-reflection. And most commentators would agree that Havel is plays are considered to be Havel's primary genre. So this is very different theater from the American conception, where we have entertainment and Cats or The Lion King doesn't necessarily provoke you to introspection and self-reflection. A few more words on this theater of the appeal and this component in Havel's theatrical style. The word appeal is actually a key word in two of Havel's genres that we'll get to in a moment, the Philosophical Letters from Prison and the post-1989 presidential speeches. And in these genres, Havel sometimes uses the word appel in Czech when he's referring to appeal. And in fact, this is the term that's used in the official term theater of the appeal, divadlo appelu. But more often, the word that he uses in these later genres is the word výzva. And výzva is roughly a synonym for appeal. Appel, we could consider it the Czech bohemized version of appel. Appel is obviously from a foreign source. But výzva is actually a rather difficult word to translate into English because it has a bunch of different meanings. And I'll list five of these meanings and you'll understand what I mean. Výzva can mean literally a call, like you get a call to board an airplane. It can be an appeal or a plea in the sense of a public appeal. It can be a summons, a bureaucratic summons of some sort. It can be a prompt on a computer screen. And it can be a challenge, as in a challenge to a duel, výzva na souboj. In the prison letters, Havel calls appeal, or výzva, the ground of all human meaning. Anything useful that has ever been said on the question of the meaning of life, Havel writes, has the nature of a výzva. Another well-known genre are the essays, 1960s through 1980s. Even though this is a well-known genre, probably what most people don't know is that it would be quite fair to say that Havel's ideas in the essays, like Power of the Powerless, are worked out first in dramatic form. So the essays could then function, or we could read them as explications du texte for the plays, explanations of the plays in a more rational, logical form. Using different terms, we might say that while the plays are focused on understanding, the essays, for the most part, are concerned with explaining. And this is a key distinction or opposition, explaining and understanding in Havel's thinking, and not only in Havel's thinking, and so I'll explain it to you here briefly. The explaining mode profiles rationality and logic. It represents an analytical approach to human meaning. And if we pause and think about the etymology of English explain, we can sort of get an idea of what the explaining mode does to the subject that it studies. Explain is Latin. The roots mean to make flat, to flatten out. I usually give the example here of people who study butterflies. You know, you can study butterflies in the wild, and they're moving around, and they're beautiful, and they're flitting from tree to tree or flower to flower. Or you can study butterflies by desiccating them, killing them, and putting them in a collection and pinning them down. That latter part is explaining, right? Understanding, on the other hand, does not deny reason its due, but it also takes into account feeling and intuition. It essentially represents a form of aesthetic perception. And I'm going to use the Czech word here to illustrate the etymology, the etymological connection. The Czech word for understand, rather like English comprehend, is chápat. And the root here is chap, which means grasping or seizing. So octopuses in Czech have chapadla, which tentacles, because you grasp or seize. So if we compare explaining as flattening out, chápat is a dynamic action, an experiential action, right? We're grabbing it, we're reaching out to it, and presumably to gain control of it or to get a sense of it, or if you're a baby, you eat it, right? So it introduces a whole human element into the equation. We could also exemplify explaining and understanding this opposition with regard to a joke. A joke, in order to fulfill its mission, needs to be understood. Nothing is less funny than a joke that needs to be explained. So the essay form is typically a mode that is associated with explaining. There are ways out of that, and Hovel makes use of those. But to add one more point, to which I'll be returning and emphasizing here, explaining also lacks an appeal component. Understanding is largely about visva, or appeal. A couple more genres. Letters from Prison, 1979 to 1983. These were collected in a book called Letters to Olga, his first wife. They are ostensibly to his first wife from prison, but really they were one side of a dialogue with fellow dissident intellectuals. They are philosophical meditations on human identity with a core vocabulary: being, faith, conscience, responsibility, spirituality. Also, and perhaps not incidentally, they contain Havel's most extensive thoughts on the nature and meaning of the theater as an artistic genre. Lots of people avoid reading the letters to Olga, even scholars who focus on Havel. They're kind of written in code because Havel needed to get the letters past prison censor, and he was only allowed to write about so-called family matters. And he, of course, was not allowed to write anything that was anti-regime. So he had to write in a rather strange code, and his translator had a great deal of trouble with this, and he wrote Havel while he was translating and said, I need some help here. I don't understand what you meant by this and this and this. And Havel wrote him a nice letter back and said, you know what, I don't really either. I can't help you. So they are written in code. They're worth reading, however, and they're worth reading as a whole and thinking about as a whole. And what I would say about the prison letters is that they need to be understood as meta-versions of his other texts. Or if you want to use a modern technological metaphor, they represent the underlying code for the more concrete and context or genre-specific manifestations of his thinking. They're the HTML code of Havel's thought. They mediate between the genres as philosophically schematized reductions of his general understanding of modern humanity. Next genre up is presidential speeches, 1990 to 2003. He wrote about 300 speeches during this time. He wrote all of his major speeches as president himself. He called politicians who don't write their own speeches run-of-the-mill politicians. The speeches can be considered somewhat of a hybrid genre. They are mini essays. They extend the same themes from the longer pre-1989 essays into the post-1989 era. But at the same time as a speech, they are performative pieces. They're like little plays in an attenuated sense. So as plays, they have at least an attenuated form of this dramatic appeal that I mentioned before. Seventh genre is the political memoir in 2006. According to the translator, Paul Wilson, who is Havel's main English translator, Havel's political memoir, which is called in English To the Castle and Back, is structurally unlike anything a former head of state has ever written. Paul has a way with understatement. Havel chose an explicit collage format for a political memoir. I don't think we can imagine that George Bush write his? He did already. I doubt it was in a collage format, right? So there are three voices or strips to the literary collage. There's a lyrical voice, a bureaucratic voice, and a rational analytical voice. And these three voices or strips interact in the memoir to exert what one critic calls a certain poetic charm on the reader. And Havel explains why he chose an explicit collage format for a political memoir. He said that the collage format represented, quote, one of the ways to touch on the hidden fabric of life in which everything is related to everything else. Everything is linked together in all kinds of ways. So it wasn't just to show that these linkages exist, but actually to problematize the linkages. The collage format challenges its readers. It appeals to them to rethink who Havel was as president, and perhaps also to rethink what politics itself is. And in this rethinking or reconceptualizing, if we think of, you know, when we go to a museum and we see a collage, how we interpret that collage, and there's some terrible collages, right? But the ones in the museum actually should be productive, should warrant thinking about, because they're going to challenge the way we think. But it's not an interpretive process that is computable. It's not systematizable. It's not mechanical. It's not, in other words, about explaining. The collage form represents an appeal to the reader. And in this regard, the memoir has much in common with Havel's theatrical style. The final genre, a bit of an odd genre, so I put it in quotes, is the genre of Havel's political activism. And it seems odd to call political activism a genre, but I think in Havel's case it is perhaps best viewed as such. And it raises the question of the extent to which the works in his literary genres can be considered political. So I'll talk about this for a moment. To what extent are his essays and plays and letters from prison and the rest of it political writings? This actually isn't an easy question to answer, and it's a really controversial question. And I think it's key for reading Havel and for reading Power of the Powerless in particular. And so let me take a stab at answering it with the help of two intellectual dissidents who knew Havel. And one of those people is named Jiřina Šiklová. She's a professor currently at Charles University. And she wrote that Havel was political all of his life. But here she makes a distinction between two kinds of political, two meanings of the word. She says there is the kind of political that's what she calls tendentiously political. That is, someone who is focused on power politics or partisan political action in a concrete sense. And then there is a kind of political which she calls authentically political. That is, political in the sense that people are social animals that form communities and are naturally engaged in questions that transcend their own personal experiences. Šiklová writes about Havel: all his life, he needed not only to reflect, not only to write, but also to become directly involved in the goings-on around him. So obviously, the argument she's trying to make is that his writings and his activism, as the eighth genre, should be considered political, but in the sense of authentically political and not tendentiously so. The second person whose help I'm invoking is Martin Palosh, and he cites Hannah Arendt and offers a reframing of Havel's politicalness in terms that are very similar to Šiklová's, tendentious versus authentic. Hannah Arendt made a distinction between an instrumental model of politics and a communicative form of politics. And Palosh notes here, quote, that in the instrumental framework, political actors strive for the success of their own political agenda and try to impose their own political will in opposition to the will of their political opponents. So that's the instrumental model. Politics is an instrument toward an end. In the communicative model, political activism is motivated by a need to achieve consensus among actors who are all looking at the same questions, but they're doing so within different frameworks or from different perspectives. So a communicative politics is not power politics in a traditional sense. It's not end or output focus, but it's a politics of process in which, to some extent at least, the very process itself is the goal. And obviously, to have an effective communicative politics, you have to have actors who are willing to engage in the process of achieving consensus. If you don't, you run into tremendous problems, and we know, have a good idea of what those problems might entail. So Palosh remarks that Havel clearly favored the communicative model. And so it's really these considerations and others that lead me to add this eighth genre, the political genre, to the list, but only in the senses described by Shiklova and Palosh. By viewing Havel's activism as coherent with his literary genres, we are both faithful to how he should be read, that is, we don't fragment the genres or atomize Havel's various faces or incarnations, alienating one from the other, but really trying to see him holistically. One of Havel's literary critical writings in his early period was devoted to another Czech writer who also engaged in cross-genre activism, or activity, productivity, and that was Josef Čapek, the brother of Karol Čapek. Karol Čapek is a little bit more famous than Josef, but Josef, in his time and place, was also quite famous. And Josef Čapek was a painter. His paintings are amazing, and you can go to Veletržní palác in Prague and see a number of his paintings hanging there. He was a writer. He wrote separately from his brother and also with his brother. I think it was Josef Čapek, actually, that coined the word robot, which entered in one of the only Czech words to enter into the international vocabulary as robot. Karol gets most of the credit, but I think it was Josef who coined it first. And he was a stage designer. And he was a leading cultural figure, an activist, a cultural activist in his time and place, much like Havel was a political activist. And what Havel says in this literary critical essay about Josef Čapek is he's been underappreciated. And the reason, paradoxically, that he's been underappreciated by the critics is because of his versatility, his mnohostrannost in Czech. And he says people fragment his genres. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to put it all together. So they don't understand that the real meaning, the pravý obsah of Čapek, Josef Čapek, is in the relations between all of those works. Sometimes people say that when we write literary criticism, we're actually writing about ourselves, right? Those things that attract us say more about ourselves than they do actually about the author that we're trying to analyze. And in general, I think there's more than a grain of truth in that. And a correlate to that for the graduate students here is that, you know, you don't, as a professor, as a researcher, you don't have many shticks in life. And normally you have two or three shticks, and they're well determined by the time you're an advanced undergrad or an early graduate student. You're going to be doing those same things for the rest of your life. So this is kind of the same thing here. So Havel's analysis of Josef Čapek definitely tells us something about Havel as a writer. And what I would like to do is propose a general principle for reading Havel across all of his genres, including the eighth genre, and I will call this the mosaic principle. And the idea here is that Havel's various genres comprise a mosaic. The individual or separate genres represent tiles. The general word here, if you don't want to talk about, because there's different kinds of mosaics, is tesserae. Who knew, right? It's a beautiful word, in the mosaic. And we could also see that within each genre, we have some genres with multiple works, and within each genre, we kind of have a fractal image going on here, that the individual works in each genre comprise a mosaic of the genre itself. So all of the letters to Olga taken together are the mosaic that comprises the book or the complete set of those works. The genres are coherent with each other as parts of this larger whole, in the same way that the tiles of a mosaic participate in a larger whole, which is the mosaic as we see it from a distance. In one of the letters to Olga, the letters from prison, Havel noted that he was not particularly consistent or systematic in the way that he explained things. And he kind of changes this here and says, or rather, that I've always felt the need to explain things in different ways. So it's not that he was inconsistent, it's that he felt the need to explain things in different ways. And we might consider this a motivation for this cross-genre productivity. And we might also consider, like with Josef Čapek, that the true meaning of all of these different explanations and explorations, in other words, our understanding of what Havel meant to say, emerges from the relationship between the genres. So reading Havel is kind of enacting what I mentioned before, which is this appeal component to meaning, this výzva, right? We take the genres as a mosaic and the individual genres as representing separate tiles, and we try to put it all together. And that very process of doing so actually is maybe what's more important than coming up with some definite conclusions. Havel wishes us to engage in that kind of process. We're now in a good position to go back finally to our main topic, which is Power of the Powerless, and the question of how to approach Power of the Powerless as a text arises. And I'm just going to talk about two possible ways of approaching it. So one way we can approach power is as a historical text about one particular time and place, one particular socio-political ism. In other words, is this essay, along with much of Havel's pre-1989 writing, a museum piece? And does it belong under glass to be admired from a safe distance? That's a strong way of putting it. Another way of approaching power is as a living document that speaks directly, or at least indirectly, to us and tells us something about our circumstances in America in 2012. And these two possible strategies, you might consider them reflective of, on the one hand, a social science approach to Havel, and on the other hand, a humanities proper approach to Havel. But I'd like to just leave that aside for a moment and use an analogy or a metaphor. Trains in America and Europe. So in America, to my endless frustration, most people think of train travel as a historical curiosity. It's a feature of America's great past associated with Manifest Destiny in the 19th century. Very few people, unless you live on certain very well-traveled routes like the Northeast Corridor, ever use Amtrak's long-distance service, or for that matter, the short-distance service. I always go to Chicago via Milwaukee so I can take the Hiawatha because I love trains. And we often glorify trains in museums devoted to them. In Europe, they have a much different relationship to trains. Trains are functional forms of real transportation. So I would like to treat Havel's texts, and power is included in this, like a European but not an American train. I want to ride that train, not just admire it and wax poetic about its role in history. I want to hop aboard it and have it take me somewhere. And so I think this is, to me, wanting to hop aboard the train is characteristic of a humanities proper approach to reading a text, in the sense that an act of reading is, to borrow a phrase from Havel himself, an existential encounter with the text, with the author, his or her context, the ideas in the text, and how those ideas relate to us. We don't read a text in a humanities course, generally speaking, from a safe distance. Another way of putting this would be to define Power of the Powerless in terms of reading poetry. And someone once said that reading poetry, or that poetry itself, gives us a secret language to talk to ourselves about ourselves. And I would argue that power can be read as doing the same thing, although that language might not be so secret. So to put our question with regard to power more clearly, is this essay literature or poetry in the sense that I've just suggested it? Is it a train ready for us to take? Or is it merely or even primarily a technical analysis of the structure of power and the political system in late 1970s Czechoslovakia? And I obviously lean on the side of the former, the humanities reading, and moreover, I think it's quite clear that Havel wished to be read in this way. So let's take a look at power and see what the text itself tells us. That is, let's see what Havel actually said. The first sentence of Power of the Powerless is, a specter is haunting Eastern Europe, the specter of what in the West is called dissent. So at the very outset, Havel announces quite clearly that his intention is to redefine and defamiliarize, to shake up old understandings and force us to actively perceive and not merely see. Havel is making two major moves in this opening line. On the one hand, I'm sure you recognize this passage, he's parodying the Communist Manifesto by substituting the word dissent where the Communist Manifesto had communism. So he's shaking things up and also probably getting under the skin of people in communist Czechoslovakia. And through the other move he's making here is putting the word dissent in quotes. And in fact, throughout the original Czech version of this essay, whenever he used the term dissent and dissident, he used quotation marks around it. At some point, some English language translator decided that that was annoying and got rid of the quote marks in all of the instances except, I think, this first one. I don't know why they felt they could make that decision. Havel didn't like the term dissident. He felt that it was a false conceptual box that people like him were forced into by Western journalists who coined the word. Being a dissident was not, Havel argued, a profession or a conscious career choice, as this term implied. And in fact, the rest of Power of the Powerless explains dissent in what we might call pre-political or existential terms, certainly not as a separate profession. Another aspect, and we're not even beyond the first page, is the dedication of the essay. That the rest of the text will present a rethinking, even a radical rethinking, of what power and dissent are is equally clear from the dedication. He dedicated the essay not to a political figure in any traditional sense of the word, but to the Czech philosopher, the phenomenologist Jan Patočka. So the whole aim of Power of the Powerless then becomes subversive on many levels. In the course of the essay, he manages to defamiliarize, at the very least, the following terms. Politics, power, dissent, totalitarianism, ideology, law, and democracy, which is not bad for one essay. At the same time, he finds it necessary to create a few new words or conceptual slots that also serve a need in his redefining project. And the main term here that he creates, the main takeaway from Power of the Powerless, is this concept of living in the truth. We'll come back to that in a moment. So, as I argued earlier, Havel is working within a framework of an authentic and communicative politics. Like Hannah Arendt, he's trying to understand and not explain power and politics. Put somewhat differently, he is outlining or attempting to enact in this essay, really in his whole oeuvre, an understanding approach to modern-day politics. And I'm not going to be able to provide an exhaustive reading of the essay in these terms, but I want to focus on several key points that illustrate what I mean by this. And these are Havel's redefinition, radical redefinition of the term ideology. And then I want to situate power in the context of his essays and works that surround it very briefly, and then talk about his account of the relationship between East and West. So it should be surprising that in an essay devoted to power and politics, Havel does not define ideology in traditionally political terms. He doesn't give a technical definition. If I was just with Judith in her office and we were on visuwords.com and we looked up ideology, and you can confirm, right? Ideology is highly politicized. It's related to one socio-political program. That is our conventional story that we associate with the term. Havel doesn't define it that way at all. He defines it in a radically different way. He mostly uses metaphor. And metaphor, if we think of the etymology, meta, across, for transfer, carrying across from one experiential domain to another experiential domain, Havel is really trying to define ideology in terms of lived through human experience. So it has this understanding component attached to it. This is one of the ways out of the rational mode of the essay is to use metaphors. So let's just look at some of these metaphors that he, a non-exhaustive list. The first one in Power of the Powerless is gloves. He says the post-totalitarian system touches people at every step, but it does so with its ideological gloves on. And as people in my class know here, I always ask, what are the gloves made of? Are they creepy latex gloves that we know we're being violated when we're being touched by them? Or are they satin gloves that caress and comfort us? I think in the context of Havel's essay, they're both, depending on the context. Another metaphor is a bridge. He says ideology is a bridge that spans the abyss between the aims of the system and the aims of life itself. And one of the things Havel implies here is that everyone living in that society has at least a foot on the bridge. Some are all the way over on the other side. Some are in the middle of the bridge. But even he has at least a foot on the bridge. No one is immune to this ideologized way of being. Another metaphor, my favorite, is a low-rent home. And he doesn't mean this in a positive sense. It's not, you don't get a great place and not pay that much. He means cheap and tawdry. But it is a home nonetheless. And in a troubling modern world, we all still need a place to call home, to feel secure, to feel comfortable, to feel like we belong. And ideology can provide just such a refuge, but it comes at a big price. Another metaphor is a veil. He says in this wonderful, devastating quote, a veil behind which human beings hide their own fallen existence, their trivialization, their adaptation to the status quo. Yet another is almost a secularized religion. And as the greengrocer knows in Power of the Powerless, a religion comes with its own set of rituals and symbols that both enact and reinforce the authority. A world of appearances trying to pass for reality. Havel says we are trapped in this world of appearances. And we aren't really aware that they're merely appearances. And if we think of the film The Matrix, you get exactly what Havel means here. So it's possible to extend this list. This isn't an exhaustive list of ideology metaphors in both Power and elsewhere, and he really only uses metaphor to define ideology, but I think these suffice to make my point, which is that for Havel, ideology is not about politics primarily. It's actually much worse than that. It's more insidious than that. It is really about who we are and how we live at some pre-political or existential level. Put another way, we might say that Havel does not offer an explanation of ideology because an explanation doesn't suffice. Only by understanding what ideology is can we make sense of it. And so we might speak in Havel more productively of ideologized being. For Havel, it's kind of a modern-day existential illness that can afflict individuals, groups, and sometimes whole societies, and we need to become diagnosticians of this disease. So I'm going to shift gears here for just a moment and illustrate that it is precisely this existential level, the one he defines ideology on, the pre-political level, that comes to the foreground when we examine Power of the Powerless in its context, that is, in the context of the essays and other works that surround it, both precede it and follow it. And by existential level here, I'm referring to the diagram on your handout. I'm referring to the right-hand portion of it. So Havel redefines the opposition between East and West. Our conventional story is East does not equal West. Communism, socialism, whichever word you want to use, does not equal capitalism. And we can extend that and say, in 1989, when the regimes fell, capitalism won, the West won, the history ended, ideology ended, blah, 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 blah. Havel is more subversive, and he requires us to think about this in different terms. And so for him, East and West are actually two sides of the same coin. And there's a mediating concept at top, which is a global crisis, a spiritual crisis of humanity. So that's what I mean when I talk about this existential level. And by looking at how Havel develops his ideas into Power and then beyond Power of the Powerless, we are, of course, putting our mosaic principle in action. And I'm not going to be able to prove it with a lot of details, but I want to just note some major moves in this direction. So there is a definite trajectory in the essays from Letter to Husak in 1975 through Power in 1978 to Politics and Conscience in 1984 and Thriller in 1984. And the trajectory is clearly focused on developing the existential level of this argument. I just want to say a brief note about Thriller. It's a wonderful essay, an odd essay in Havel's oeuvre. It's only 5 or 6 pages. It's incredibly lyrical, which is unusual for Havel. And it's named for Michael Jackson's video and song about vampires and zombies, right? And it's also a collage format. Havel was a bit obsessed with the collage format. It starts off with a collage of news reports. Indira Gandhi has been assassinated by one of her own bodyguards. There is a famine in Africa, and a girl in California has been given the heart of a baboon. And the entire essay plays out at the existential level. There is no explicit reference to the socialist totalitarian context. You wouldn't even know it was written in that context if you didn't already know it. Not surprisingly, most commentators on Havel simply ignore this essay, because it doesn't, in fact, fit into a conventional reading of Havel as an anti-communist dissident. If you read, however, what Havel actually wrote, then Thriller begins to seem like a key essay, a kind of culminating point for the essays in terms of this existential trajectory. The letters from prison were obliged to be written because he was imprisoned immediately after Power from 1978 to 1983. And as I already mentioned, these are philosophical metatexts. They focus exclusively on the existential level, maybe also because of the fact that he wasn't allowed to write about explicit themes and had to pass them through the censor. If we think about the plays and consider that Havel was primarily a playwright, we might look at the plays from the 1970s, and these also clearly represent a focus on this higher level of reading. And the three plays I have in mind here are the so-called Vanyek plays. They're 3 one-act plays related to each other with the same character whose name is Vanyek, who is nominally a dissident. And he interacts with various characters. One is a brewmaster in the first play. Two other people are his friends from obviously college days who have taken a different approach to normalization to the regime after the Soviet invasion in 1968. And the final play deals with an interaction with a fellow intellectual who has also decided to inhabit this gray zone and cooperate more or less with the regime in order to save his career. But what is clear from this is that the plays is that Havel is not talking only or speaking only or writing only in reference to totalitarian Czechoslovakia. And he himself was very clear about that. He considered his plays would be a failure if they were interpreted as only relating to that particular time and place. And the Vaněk plays in particular are wildly successful, and they were staged all over the world. And I would say the middle play, which is called Private Exhibition, Vernissage in Czech, probably speaks more to the modern American context than it does to the... It's about a bunch of yuppies, essentially, who are trying to fill an emptiness, a spiritual emptiness in their lives by redecorating their apartment. So we could also go back, all the way back to the Lit Crit writings and the Anticodes to confirm that Havel has an obsession with an existential reading of the question raised by the life in post-totalitarian society. So I'm going to switch gears again, and I want to reinforce this existential reading by mentioning how Havel deals with East and West, our little chart, in Power itself. So what does Havel actually say about East and West, or West in terms of East, in Power of the Powerless, and not only in this essay? And it might surprise some of us to learn that he addresses the West at all in Power, because this essay is so strongly associated with totalitarian Czechoslovakia. So let's look at two citations from Power where Havel makes this explicit, and this was on the title slide, the beautiful quote. "And in the end, is not the grayness and the emptiness of life in the post-totalitarian system only an inflated caricature of modern life in general? And do we not, in fact, stand as a kind of warning to the West, revealing to it its own latent tendencies?" So a second quote, a little more complicated. It would help to have it. "The post-totalitarian system is only one aspect, a particularly drastic aspect, of the general inability of modern humanity to be the master of its own situation. The automatism of the post-totalitarian system is merely an extreme version of the global automatism of technological civilization. The human failure it mirrors is only one variant of the general failure of modern humanity," which is exactly the chart that we have on our handout. So what we could say is that there are definitely, and these aren't exhaustive quotes, I could have introduced more, that there are definitely two levels of analysis made explicit in Power and other works. There is the domestic level, which is the analysis of the post-totalitarian system in Central Europe, and then there's a much broader framework which actually encompasses and informs that domestic level, which is that mediating concept on your chart, the existential level or a civilizational crisis. And I just want to make a note here. I'm not suggesting, and I don't think Havel is suggesting, that you can compare directly totalitarian East and democratic, or what Havel calls post-democratic West. You have to resort to some mediating structure. It's like trying to compare an apple and a banana, right? If we didn't know that both apples and bananas were fruit, fruit is the mediating structure, it would be very difficult actually to see them as similar and to talk about those similarities. And I think that's exactly what the kind of structure that Havel is giving us in this essay. So if we ignore the relationship between East and West, we become like these generals that Havel mentions in another essay, in Politics and Conscience. And he says, "The totalitarian East is a great reminder to contemporary civilization. Perhaps somewhere there may be generals who think it would be best to dispatch such systems from the face of the earth, and then all would be well. But that is no different from an ugly woman trying to get rid of her ugliness by smashing the mirror that reminds her of it." Apologies for Havel's sexism here. I'm going to begin summing up, and I'm almost finished. I wanted to just introduce very quickly a cautionary tale. And that cautionary tale has to do with a recent book from 2010, Paulina Brenn's The Greengrocer and His TV. This is a history of the period of normalization. It's actually an excellent book. She decided that normalization was a period where nothing happened, and so the challenge was how to write a history about it. And she decided to do a cultural history through TV and TV serials and what that said about society at the time. However, in the course of this essay, she talks about Havel's concept of living in the truth. And she calls the concept rigid and inflexible. And she claims that Havel has a distaste for the greengrocer, who is the main storyline in Power of the Powerless. She says that Havel sets up a binary kind of system in which we have either people were living in the truth or they were living in lies, and that this is reflective of existing historiography, which deals in binaries, and that's too reductionist. So she essentially accuses Havel of being an elitist and saying that I know what it is to live in the truth, I know how to live in the truth, and you aren't doing it, and therefore I don't like you, I have a distaste for you, like the green grocer. When I was reading this part of Paulina Brenn's book, I was nearly, my mouth was open, and I was like, are you reading the same essay that I read? Obviously, I think she distorts living in the truth. It's not a rigid or inflexible concept. I don't think he has a distaste for the greengrocer. And I think she does so because she does not respect the Mosaic principle. She doesn't even make a minimal effort, actually. She only references Power of the Powerless, and then, even then, she misreads the essay. She makes no attempt to give credit to Havel for problematizing life in truth in the plays, in the Vanyek plays, or the Letters from Prison, nor does she see that this concept is not only applicable to the East, but also has a function in the modern world in general. In other words, Paulina Brenn sees Havel's concept as a form of explaining, pinning down that dead butterfly, right? She doesn't understand that Havel intends living in truth as a visva, that is, a call or appeal oriented toward understanding. Finally, I'm going to restate our two traps at the beginning. And the first of these traps I'm going to restate as the trap of fragmenting Havel's genres. Havel explained things in different ways in order to avoid falling into the intellectual trap of totalizing discourse. Paulina Brenn accuses Havel of something that he actually took very careful steps to avoid. In other words, Havel knew that Ionesco's speaker was a fraud before he even heard the speaker's screeches. The second trap I'm going to restate as the trap of relegating Havel's writings to a museum piece. What Havel actually wrote tells us that this is an inappropriate strategy. It is neither faithful to Havel's actual text, nor is it how he wished to be read. And I would suggest to you that many critics and commenters on Havel fall into both of these traps simultaneously. Summing up his legacy with an anecdote. Before I came to UW, I was a professor at a nameless university in Colorado. And I taught Russian there, but it was also known on campus that I studied Czech. And as a result, a colleague in political science invited me to be on a senior thesis committee, to be the final reader on this committee. And the subject of the thesis was Václav Havel, who I knew quite well even then, and specifically whether Havel could be considered a charismatic leader in Max Weber's sense of the term. And by the time I joined this committee, the thesis was already written in final form, and my task was to go to the thesis defense and to ask a question. Those of us who've been on thesis defense know we always have to ask a question. So when it was my turn to ask a question, I said, and I've kept the exact questions. This is the exact question I asked. In your detailed study of Havel as a charismatic leader in the Czech and Czechoslovak contexts, do you feel that you learned something from Havel's experience that could be translated to modern-day America? Did studying Havel teach you anything about American society and politics, or maybe even something about yourself? She didn't mention this in the essay at all. It was absolutely left out of it. To my shock and my horror, because I didn't think it was actually an unfair or mean question, the student froze up and was unable to answer. It was clear that she had never even begun to think about Havel in this way. And then it got worse because she began to cry. And at that point, my colleague from political science who invited me glared at me. And I was at that university for a whole other year and he never spoke to me again. Wasn't my fault. And by the way, the conclusion of the thesis was, yes, Havel could be considered a charismatic leader in Max Weber's sense of the term. And I think this anecdote sums up rather neatly how Havel is typically read, or rather misread. And I'll conclude with two thoughts. Havel's works across all eight of his genres should be read as attempts not to explain, but to understand. And coupled with that, his works and his legacy ought to be properly understood as forms of visva, pleas, calls, summonses, prompts, challenges and appeals. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions or even better engage in a discussion in the Visva mode.